electric brake line then. So we've got, I think, three sessions lined up for you today on different parts of the discussion paper that we put out 3 months ago now. We're about halfway through the comment period. So we picked some topics that we thought you'd be interested in. And the first one is to do with our old friends, Professor Loss and OCI. And I'm sure you all remember we had a discussion on this in June at the joint meeting with the global group there as well. But we thought we'd bring that back for some follow-up. So agenda paper one summarises the things that we thought would be worth discussing with you on this topic today. So I want to remind you why this issue is important, how it works today, and then summarise the preliminary views and ask you some questions. Turning to slide three, why is it important? Well, the different treatments, different types of gains and losses, some going through P&L, some going through OCI. There's not necessarily been a clear rationale for them in the past. Obviously, they affect headline ratios that people produce, so even if people are making adjustments for the things, it's still extra work, and it might be useful to rationalise the distinction between OCI and P&L. And indeed consider whether we should keep a distinction at all. As we point out on slide four, when we did the gender consultation in 2011, pretty much everybody said that we did need to put some order into this space and to explain why we're using OCI and whether we should be recycling, and if we are recycling, whether we should be doing that consistently, because at the moment it looks like a series of random decisions. In fact, I don't think it is actually a random decision. I think it's a product of the time when the decisions were made, when different philosophies were enforced at the time when the decisions were made. But now you lose the sequence, you forget that there was a sort of historical series of rationales. Hopefully we can replace that with a single rationale that will be understandable to people. Slide 5 gives some examples of various types of remeasurements. Some of them go into profit or loss, for example, goodwill impairments, inventory write-downs, change in estimates of legal costs if you have a big provision for legal liability, for example. Some go to OCI and never recycled, for example, pensions, and a couple of things that we've had in recent changes to standards. If you have change in the fair value of financial liability, where you've been using the fair value option, the part of it that's attributable to your own credit risk will be going through OCI. That's a relatively recent change to the standards. Similarly, the approach in IFRS 9 for the option to use OCI, the change in fair value of some equity instruments, that goes to OCI and there's no recycling back out of OCI on sale or impairment. So there's no testing for impairment. It's all fair value changes. And then other value changes are reported in OCI, but they are recycled at some point in the future. I'm assuming that you all know what recycling is, but maybe I should actually just remind you what that is if you haven't come across it. So it's the notion that when you've had a gain that's been reported, gain or loss that's been reported in OCI, at some stage it passes back through profit or loss. So for example, if you've had under the proposals in IFRS 9, if you had a debt instrument that's in this category of fair value through OCI, the fair value change is going through OCI. If you sell that debt instrument, the gain that's been stored up in OCI gets reclassified into profit or loss as part of the gain or loss on disposal of the instrument. So that's what we mean when we talk about recycling. It's a gain or loss that's already been reported in OCI in some previous period, then being reported in profit or loss in some later period. Has everybody come across that notion? Okay, so what I'd like, I should just carry on with slide 5. So a couple of other examples. The middle box there in the third column is the example I just gave, which is a debt instrument under this fair value OCI category in the IFRS 9 exposure draft, where the changes in fair value are stored up in OCI and then recycled on disposal or impairments. And the third example is a cash flow hedge. where the hedging instrument, the fair value changes, are stored up in OCI, and then when the hedge transaction actually occurs and hits profit or loss, then that gain or loss on the derivative is transferred, recycled into profit or loss, so the two pieces are in profit or loss at the same time. Any questions on that so far? Okay, so what are we doing? What are we proposing in the discussion paper? Well, the first thing we did actually was to look at whether we should keep the distinction between profit or loss or OCI. And actually the board came to the conclusion fairly quickly it probably did need to keep the distinction. It seemed to be one that was quite important to people, that there were some types of gains or losses that somehow seemed to get in the way of the results of profit or loss. It's not a universal view, but it seems to be the dominant view at the time. So most of the board's discussion was really about how to distinguish between profit or loss and OCI. There have been various suggestions over the years for how you might make the distinction. Some of those are listed on slide 7. For example, is it recurring or non-recurring? Can management control it or not? Is it operating or not non-operating? Is the thing easy to measure or hard to measure? Is it short-term or long-term? And we didn't find any of those really persuasive as the basis for a single distinction.
I'm a bit sad that we're sort of dismissing the idea of not having a bridge between them, not having a line between P&L and OCI. We had, in the earlier financial statement presentation project, there was interesting experimentation with a variety of columns that showed that did distinguish between operating, different types of remeasurements, and so on, and left us to, as happens at the moment, actually left various people to work out where they wanted to draw a line in terms of defining earnings per share, for the sort of preparers doing it in one place and the users doing it in another place. So that's one concern I've got with P&L and OCI, what's the other one?
I thought Peter was saying that they were going to keep sort of effectively two statements, or they were going to differentiate between profit and loss and OCI.
Well, let me just actually clarify on a couple of points there. First of all, on the question of one statement or two statements, we decided that we think that's something that the framework itself doesn't need to address. So that would still be a decision to be taken in individual standards.
I don't think you just give us stuff whether it's one page or two. It's whether there's a clear break, a subtotal is the key.
So we're not addressing the one statement or two.
The other thing is that you then end up describing the profit and loss account as the default, which is odd.
Well, let me come back to that point as well. But the other point I want to make is about operating profit. We also decided that the framework shouldn't really address what other subtotals or totals you need to have. That's still a standards level decision. So it's, at the moment it's governed by IS1. In whatever work we do on presentation and disclosure at the standards level, we would look at whether we need totals like operating profit, for example. So we're not saying now...
Doesn't rule out further refinement of what within P&L.
On your point about the defaults, I'll come back to that in a second, actually, because it'll come naturally a bit later on. The other questions so far. So we didn't find any of those as really a suitable basis for making a distinction between profit or loss or OCI. So what we did next was to look at what sort of criteria or guidelines we could assume we could find for making a distinction of the work that's based on a single criteria. And we looked at whether we could or should define what goes into profit or loss or define what goes into OCI. Dennis?
I missed part of the last session on this, so I just perhaps want to confirm that we're moving on beyond trying to identify what should be in profit or loss or OCI based on what's on slide 7. I think that the group should kind of agree or disagree whether we move on and find alternative solutions, or whether we believe there's actually room to find a distinction, a conceptual philosophical distinction between what should be in profit or loss or OCI.
So if I can, I was trying to sort of form my piece here, but I I'd like to be as constructive as I possibly can, and I realize that you guys are facing some serious challenges. But this is a conceptual project. You are clearly backfilling some of these conceptual arguments are clearly backfill. You're here and you sort of want to patch some, bridge some concepts. And what is the fundamental principle behind performance? And there is no discussion about what is performance. And I use performance very carefully. Performance probably, and this is where I'm guessing, but there's a P&L element, there might be an OCI element, there might even be a change within owner's equity section. Performance is more than just the change in assets and the change in liabilities. There's a whole, the highest level principle concept is decision useful information for users. Probably I think there's some sort of concept of performance needs to be injected, and then that performance is probably multidimensional, and then you have to ask yourself, what are the dimensions of performance? And to be honest, I actually think there might actually be something that looks a little like OCI that pops out at the bottom of this process, but you're going backwards. You're sort of starting with an OCI and then sort of trying to build conceptual pieces on top of it. And I think this project would be a lot more genuine if you just said, well, we're here. We can't solve the performance conceptual problem immediately. Let's try to put some order in OCI that a couple of people have already mentioned that the conceptual project is actually the most important thing. So we might be better just stepping back and understanding we're here. We can't change the world right away. Let's at least be intellectually honest about what we're doing. And I think
maybe slide 9 actually addresses some of your concerns.
Is the profit and loss a primary indicator?
Mm-hmm. Well, from the market's perspective, yes, absolutely.
Is that the only thing you look at?
No, primary. But not only primary.
Okay. If I'm...
In any discussion on the microphone, JP Morgan, anywhere in the world, 7:05 after the results come out, you will not hear people talking about OCI remeasurements. You will hear them talking about EBITDA, EBIT, earnings, return on equity, da-da-da-da-da.
And every
primary measure.
And every financial analyst worth their salt will say, don't look at one number, look at everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Look at OCI.
But primary is what we're saying here. And then, at sort of 7:20, you get the results statement, you start digging, you go to the conference call, you start doing analysis, you build your model, you talk to management, you write a note. You know, the iterative process goes on, and eventually you get to page 350 in the annual report, and you start analyzing their contingent liabilities.
I'm terrified. The word is actually called headline earnings, and that's an ancient discussion. And I'm terrified of it because what happens is if somebody focuses on one number, well, the treasury team and the accounting team will do leases versus purchases. They'll do all sorts of things to make sure that the headline earning is right. And then you have to go through the 300 pages to find out that actually what they've done is they've sold all their receivables, they've rented everything, and that the leverage it gives it is much higher.
The problem, well, I completely agree with what you're saying, and I totally agree with your concerns, and I've seen clear evidence that those sorts of things play out. But the problem we have, I think, is that accounting standards have to sort of start with where the world is, are not right standards for where they want the world to be. Now, we've had a long philosophical debate over decades as to, you know, why earnings is not the right number, why there are many, many other indicators. And there are a number of sort of accounting philosophers who say, well, just it's total comprehensive income. Just give them everything and let them sort it out. A bit like what Jed was saying earlier about lease accounting, you know, for a large number of users around the world, giving them everything is just a whole bucket of noise.
So
you really want to help people.
I think you picked up on something. We are not starting with a blank sheet. We're starting from where we are. So I think what the way we salvage progress out of this is to try to put some order in OCI, try to make some sort of logic, and defer some of the fundamental questions by just not saying there's a conceptual framework for it for the moment. We don't have a clear conceptual framework. I'm peeking forward, but profit and loss is going to be probably is going to be the primary, particularly if nobody games it. You're right. I think there's some very interesting discussions that really need to be solved at the conceptual level. And for instance, OCI, I think, makes a lot of sense for derivatives when you're not in a financial institution. But I really struggle with, if you really are in the business of moving, and unfortunately insurance companies are in there, banks and insurance companies, I'm not sure OCI really makes as much sense. If you are a widget maker and you've got some derivatives and you've got some fair value, OCI makes a lot of sense in the sort of the direction we're going with recycling. But this is a conceptual conversation, and I had to put in the place marker. You don't have the start.
I think it might be useful to hear Peter's summary of slide 8 and maybe get into 10, because I think there are some approaches that we've been discussing on the table, and then we need to see if any of that sorts out what's being discussed.
Maybe it's an answer to Dennis's question. Actually, which I thought was quite a good one. So we just take it as read that, you know, slide 7's not the basis of different columns.
I think I'd prefer to come back to that towards the end, actually, because I think it's all part of the same package, really. I wanted to comment on two things that Robert said. You said quite early on that we didn't try to define performance, but then actually I think some things you said later on explained why we didn't try to define a number as meaning performance. And I think if we tried to define a number as performance, we'd be doomed to failure. There's no chance of it making it possible. I think that's also actually a bit related to the question of should profit or loss be the default or not? We thought that conceptually, you could either define, assuming you're keeping two categories, you could either define profit or loss and use OCI as the default, or you can define what goes into OCI, profit or loss, as the default. We thought it was more difficult to define profit or loss because you're going to want to see most things in there, and if you try and define it, I don't think you're going to come up with a good conceptual discussion that says distinction that makes it very clear what's in there. It would end up being a shopping list, and if it's a shopping list, you're going to leave things off. So we thought that there's too much risk of unintended consequences trying to define profit or loss, so we're better trying to pin down what kind of things go outside of profit or loss. You said that we're backfilling, and I actually think that's quite unfair, because I think what we did, we went through the things on slide 7, found that we didn't really think any of them worked. What we did on slide 8 was not backfilling. But what we were trying to do was come up with some rationale for why you might want to exclude some things from OCI. So perhaps if I go through the things on slide 8 and try and explain what we were doing there, and I don't think that is backfilling, so certainly not entirely. So we identified three categories of items where we thought there was a case for excluding from profit or loss. The first category is... actually, let me take the middle one first. That's probably the easiest to take. We labelled these as mismatch remeasurements. And this is where you've got a transaction, but it's part of some wider transaction, and it's not all captured in the accounting system at the same time. The obvious example is the cash flow hedge. You're using a derivative to hedge some future sales in your foreign subsidiary. The derivative, you've got some fair value changes going on, but the sales won't occur till next year. And so, in a sense, you're getting some noise there because you've only got one part of that set of linked transactions. And so the notion here was, well, maybe we don't want the fair value change on a derivative in profit or loss, because they're important, but they'll cloud the issue a bit if they're in this sort of primary location. So let's store them up in OCI. Now, interestingly, I think that leads you to a point as to what to do about the recycling question. Because if your rationale for excluding them is that you've only got one part of the transaction occurring, so that you can deal with them at the same time as the transaction has occurred, then that suggests that once the hedged item occurs, you ought to deal with them in the same place somewhere. And if we're using profit or loss as the default, it's probably matching them up in profit or loss rather than matching them up in OCI. So that seems to suggest to what to do with recycling for that category. Another one we thought might be an example of a mismatch measurement is foreign currency translation for foreign subsidiaries. Not the transaction gains and losses, but just the conversion effect you get because you're converting the financial statements from the foreign currency into the base currency, the reporting currency. And yes, that gives you some information about fair value, about the rate changes, but it's kind of imperfect because it's based on the recognised assets and liabilities that are partly monetary, that are partly non-monetary. It's not capturing all the unrecognised assets, so it's sort of an incomplete piece of information. And again, we thought, in a sense, it's incomplete because you're not really capturing all the forex changes in the same place. We also thought that if you actually sell the subsidiary, at that point you have got everything back together again, and it probably does make sense to recycle at that point, if that was your rationale for this category. So that was the mismatch category, and we felt there was quite a strong case for saying, well, maybe we should use OCI for that. Second category we labelled as bridging items. And what this is where the board decides, for whatever reason, and we can maybe come back to that, that it wants to use two different measurements. And it's going to use one measurement as the basis for reporting the balance sheet, and the other measurement as the basis for reporting in profit or loss. We've got two examples of that at the moment. One example is the example I've quoted a couple of times, the fair value through OCI category for some debt instruments that's proposed in the IFRS 9 classification of measurements. So the notion there was that your business model is that you might be collecting cash flows by holding to maturity, or you might be collecting by selling, or you might be doing a mixture of them. You don't really know yet what. And so both amortized cost and fair value information are likely to be useful to you. And what the OCI enables you to do there is to show a kind of two-dimensional view of this asset. You get the amortized cost information in P&L, you get the fair value information in the balance sheet, and OCI provides the bridge between them. Actually, to be accurate, it's not really OCI that provides the bridge, but it's cumulative OCI. Because it's the cumulative OCI is the difference between the two measurements. The movement, the current period OCI is the movement and the difference. So it's actually a bit harder to really pin down what that means. In fact, I think that the economic significance of that movement is actually made up of two components, and it might be clearer if we separated them. The difference between fair value and OCI is basically interest rate changes for this category, because theoretically the cash flow changes are being picked up in amortized costs already. I know the impairment model's a bit imperfect, but theoretically the cash flow estimate changes are being picked up in amortized costs. So OCI is picking up really interest rate changes. And so there are two components of the OCI for the current period. One is there's an effect if there's a rate change. So if the rate's changed this year, obviously that affects the fair value, and consequently there's an effect in the current period OCI. Even if rates don't change, though, there's another effect as well, which is a sort of a pull to par or an unwinding effect. Because as it's about interest rate changes, as time passes, that effect unwinds, and so that differential gradually unwinds as well. And it's a bit hard to really see what that is. That's more a kind of arithmetic difference, maybe, more than something that you could really say it's got a very clear meaning. So I think that's another reason maybe for saying that you might want that two-dimensional view. One dimension is basically largely about interest rate changes. And if you think of what's going on in insurance contracts, that's basically the same thing as well. where we said we've got a measurement in the balance sheet that's using all current inputs, including current interest rates. And in profit or loss, we're using all current inputs, except for interest rates, where we're using the original interest rates. And so what's going into OCI there, again, admittedly a bit imperfectly, but what's going into OCI there is the effect of interest rate changes. That information is important, but we think it's quite useful to keep it separately. Because what, one of the odd things about interest rate effects is, of course, they do unwind naturally over time. If you keep the liability, most people keep the liability, then it will unwind naturally. But having said that, that's only part of the story as well, because that doesn't mean you can ignore it. Because the cumulative OCI also gives you a snapshot of your exposure to the interest rate risk. And that's not just about if you sell the thing, but also if you've got duration mismatches between your assets and liabilities. The OCI has given you some information about those duration mismatches as well. So we think there's some useful information there. And so the notion in the bridging is that actually that there is a useful function, there's a separate piece of information. OCI is quite a convenient way of separating that particular piece of information. Jane?
When you just described the insurance contracts unwinding bit, sounded as though that could also be described under your fascinating new heading, transitory commitments.
Yeah, come back to that. So those two categories, the board thought there was quite a strong case for using OCI for those. But this is maybe where part of the sort of backfilling notion might come in, that would end up with quite a narrow population of items. And there's a table in the DP that lists the cases where we use OCI. These two capture about half of them, roughly, a bit less than half even, probably. So we looked at sort of what distinguished the other cases where we've used it in the past to see if we could identify any common themes. And we thought that the sort of common-ish themes were long-term, quite volatile, and where you might get a lot of noise for including. So we set up some criteria that are really based on those thoughts. We've labelled that as transitory remeasurements. Now, to give you an example of something that would be in that transitory category but wouldn't be in either of the first two, pensions, the way we've got it in IAS 19 at the moment, where the service cost and the interest cost is going through P&L, the actuarial gains and losses are going through OCI, and there's no recycling. Now, that doesn't meet our notion of bridging. Why is that? Well, if you look at the if you look at slide 15, maybe I can explain it with that. So, in this example, we've got 2 years. In the first year, we have service cost of 10. And in the second year, we had service costs of 12. And let's assume that everything else has stayed the same. It's just there's been a change in your estimate, maybe a change of estimate of how long the employees will live or something like that. So if you look at it in balance sheet terms, the liability is now 24, the 2 years of service cost. But the cumulative amount that's gone through P&L is only 22, because we had 10 last year and we've got 12 this year. And the problem is that 22, you can't really reconcile that with any sort of natural measurement of the liability. It's just an accumulation of the things you've booked over the years. You couldn't construct a balance sheet with a liability of 22 that would have any meaning. It is just an accumulation. And that's the difference from the bridging notion, where in the bridging notion, we're using a kind of coherent measurement to derive the numbers of the P&L, whereas in this one, it's more a kind of year-by-year calculations accumulating, but you couldn't construct a balance sheet out of the numbers that have gone out through P&L, not a meaningful balance sheet out of the numbers that have gone through P&L.
But the change in interest rates would mean the bridging?
It would by itself. The difference in pensions here is that each year in IAS 19 we're accumulating at current interest rates, whereas, for example, in insurance what we're doing is we're saying that the P&L information is generated by the original interest rate at inception. So in pensions you've got a series of layers building up, whereas in insurance it's really a continuing measurement at the original rates.
So is this catch-up a permanent change? Is it a change in the mortality rate of permanent change in mortality rate of employees, or is it the change in pension liability relating to, for instance, interest or something?
Well,
benefit
if it's all of those, in fact. So it's a mixture of all of those things. So the interest effect, of course, will reverse back out over time, whereas the mortality effect, if your assumptions don't change again in the future and end up being actual, that clearly will have a cash effect. Obviously.
So just help me out. In 2002, you booked 12, and in one you booked 10, and you're two off, is what you're saying. Why don't you want to run the catch up through the P&L?
Well, you could, but I think the board decided not to when it's like IAS 19, and I think there's a legitimate question about whether it's better to have it in P&L or in CI. And IAS 19 does as well deal together with all those things like mortality, change in the fair value of the plan assets, discount rate changes, all of that's all in one melting pot. So you might say, well, maybe we should go back to IAS 19 and try and disentangle it a bit, and maybe there are some other components that we should put in P&L.
That begs the question, maybe this isn't the best example to use in that case, put it that way.
I think it probably is an interesting example, because I think where OCI, the use of OCI adds most value from financial analysis is where you indeed want to see you want to update the liability, obviously, but that in the P&L, you want to have the best possible start point for building your future projections. And probably the catch-up of two is probably not an amount that you want to peg as your start point
I think it really depends on what it was. If it truly is a catch-up for an error that was 3 years ago, you're right. But if it's because they've just renegotiated the union contract, and in fact that has implications on... I think we can construct some examples that really is it should be recognized as a cost this year. And so that's why that sort of that comment about just because it was bundled in the existing standard doesn't mean... I think that's the weak link of the logic. I think there are cases where you're absolutely correct. It's a revaluation or it's a catch-up that really would mislead if it was run through the P&L 1 year. But there are also some categories. So that's why my comment is as long as we've got a bunch of things in here and it could be anything, it may not be fair.
And for me, the value of OCI is that those elements in OCI are the ones you would take out as an analyst if they weren't there, you know? You want to take them out for the start point of modeling.
There are lots of examples of that that don't play for us. We've just made a special case of pension. I guess the concern that I have is that there's then a sort of significant incentive for management to systematically underestimate service costs. And that, you know, you're always having to bleed in these extra costs through OCI that nobody thinks about as earnings.
But Jed, in fairness, you get to do that 3 years. The fourth year, the analysts say, oh, yeah, okay, now, and they'll just...
Well, except in OCI, it's bundled with a whole load of other actuarial movements that you can't track.
Yeah.
I think, are we... The catch-up maybe is not that useful a word for it. I thought you were talking about stuff that isn't catch-up necessarily, stuff that moves around, but will unwind over a long-term contract, effectively. I mean, what I'm assuming is that other types of catch-up, so for example, you know, BT is making a regular large payment to its pension funds, and then when it's flush with cash, it'll bung in another 300 million or something every so often. I'm assuming that bunging in the other 300 million, that sort of catch-up, goes through the P&L as an additional service cost.
No,
that,
it doesn't. No, the current pensions account.
It doesn't appear in either of the performance statements.
It's a cash flow item.
It's paying down the liability.
Yeah.
And increases the assets on the pension scheme.
But you're right, Jane, you can see it in the cash flow statement.
Yeah.
As a payment.
Well, in that case, I thought this might just be to do with changing discount rates for liabilities or something like that. Not, you know, if it is for catch-ups, like one-off payments, I'd rather those be sort of paid out.
I mean, pensions is an interesting example.
They tend to get reversed. I mean, the idea of transitory should be that it can be reversed. Whereas, you know, BT's not going to grab that $300 million back.
No, I mean, I think if you look at pensions, you know, you could, on the liability side, if we were using the same sort of conceptual framework as insurance, then liability changes broadly would be going through OCI, and it's subject to some difficult bits around the edge. And if we were looking at the asset side, then again, broadly, there's a conceptual sort of basis for putting that through OCI as well. So I don't know whether actually we need to justify a lot of what we do with pensions as a transitory remeasurement. And I sort of share the concerns of this catch-up, although totally take Martin's point, if I'm forecasting, I want to see the 12, that's the service cost, but provided in the P&L, this is labelled as, I don't know, past service corrections or assumption changes or something that tells me it's a difference between sort of action and budget, then I can adjust for that when I get to the detail of doing my forecast. So have you got any other examples of what would classify as a transitory remeasurement?
Yeah, I've got one or two more. Let me. Can I maybe just see what Peter's question is first?
Oh, continue. I can.
Because I wanted to make a couple of other points about this as well. One is about recycling. I forgot to say that the bridging items, that the recycling answer there also pops out automatically. So if you take the debt instrument example, if what you're trying to do is show amortized cost information in P&L, fair value in the balance sheet, then the only way to get information based on amortised cost in P&L is that you have to recycle when you sell the asset or on impairment, because otherwise you won't have a consistent set of amortised cost information. For the transitory remeasurements, what the board has suggested there is that you would recycle if recycling is going to produce useful information. And the pension cost, the pension example is interesting there, because we haven't been able to find a basis for recycling. Other than something that's entirely arbitrary, like using a corridor or something. And it's linked to the fact, really, that it's not based on an underlying measure in the P&L. Because there's no measure, there is no rational time to recycle. You could recycle at the end of the life of the scheme, but that's sort of, in a sense, ducking the question. And so pensions would be one where probably we don't recycle at the moment, and probably in this setup, if you're using OCI for it, you still wouldn't if we have the same composition of what's gone into the OCI. Now, in terms of other items that might go in here, I think this is linked to this as well, to Robert's point about are we backfilled or not. That there are some other current uses of OCI that don't fit, certainly in the first two categories, they might possibly fit the third category. So, for example, I mentioned earlier the change in fair value of financial liabilities because of your own credits. At the moment in the standard, you say you don't recycle there. So at the moment, that's not consistent with our bridging notion or our mismatch notion. Now, we could make it consistent, perhaps, by recycling if you manage to transfer the liability. Another example is fixed asset revaluations. And there are two reasons why that's not consistent with the bridging item. The first is that depreciation is based on the revalued amount. It's not based on original cost, and so there's not a measurement that's consistent with the amounts going through P&L. And secondly, we don't recycle on disposal. Now, we can convert it to a mismatch item by using depreciated historic costs in P&L and by recycling on disposal. But that's not the way it works at the moment. Now, I think an interesting question about could you have other bridging items, other transitory items that aren't mismatch or bridging. I'm not sure there are others at the moment, and I'll ask Chris to help me out there, but there are other cases in the standards where we're using P&L that could qualify as transitory. For example, if you have some sort of environmental rehabilitation liability, at the moment the changes go through P&L, but it will certainly fit this notion of transitory. What we said there is the board would be compelled to use OCI for these. It would decide on a case-by-case basis, but it certainly could fit. Investment property, another example perhaps. If you wanted to use amortised cost information in P&L for investment property and fair value in the balance sheet, then that would fit either the bridging item or it could fit the transitory renotion. So I think this structure here, we've got what it will do, although it's still not sort of a cookbook that says you have to use OCI in these cases, I think it would put some more structure around it, which might be helpful. Now, the board was undecided, really, whether to go for the sort of narrower view of just having the board bridging items and the mismatch items, or whether to go the extra step and have the transitory items. The bridging and mismatch, I think, are much more tightly defined and clearer. The transitory is a much fuzzier category. And I think if the board is looking at taking this forward, that's the trade-off between having a tightly defined set of criteria or a looser set of criteria. And with the knowledge that some of the existing uses of OCI certainly don't fit very well into the narrower criteria. Probably most of them you can fit roughly into the transitory, but there might be one or two things at the edges there. So.
May I ask, because you're saying loosely defined, and I think probably transitory, which is more like, sounds like it could be anything, potentially, could still be tightly defined.
Yeah.
And this is something, I mean, the logic why we would like to see mismatched items, to use OCI for mismatched items, could equally apply, because it enhances the insight for other, which we could mention, transitory items, as long, and that's Jess' point, you don't want management to go on the run and use that use it as a stick to drop underperformance in OCI. So if you tightly define the loosely defined transitory item, you can. I think you would meet lots of investor concerns.
Yeah, but one important thing I should have mentioned was that we saw these as criteria for the board to use, not for preparers to use. So the board would say at the standard level, you use OCI for this, you don't use OCI for that. It wouldn't be for preparers then to sort of try and supplement that.
Where would changes in discount rate on long-term environmental obligations go, which currently go through P&L? If you define them, but economically they're very similar to the change in discount rate on a pension liability, would you be looking to sort of change that, or would you say that's the right place for them to go because they will crystallise in time and you always want to have the true up running through P&L?
Well, I think, let's say we introduce this. What the board would need to do would be to decide to think about that for the next agenda, really, what to do with that. And probably the board ought to say in the ED sort of roughly what the implications might be. When the board is setting the next agenda, consistency with the framework is one of the factors that it will need to consider, but there are plenty of other factors as well. We're planning to do the next agenda consultation in roughly 2015. That'll be one of the inputs to that. So, one possibility is you might say, well, now we've got to use for OCI, we should try and make everything consistent. Or another approach might be to say, well, we'll wait and deal with the individual issues as they come up. Peter, I held you back.
I'm very much in favour of the OCI. I think it's extremely helpful to understand the development of total earnings in the company. And I have looked at this quite thoroughly from a Swedish perspective. I have analysed roughly 160 Swedish companies each quarter since 2009. And what I find from a Swedish perspective, since we have this ridiculous currency that we call the krona, of course, everything relating to currencies dominates, in particular the translation adjustment in foreign subsidiaries, which easily can be as big as the quarterly earnings for a certain quarter easily. I would not like to have that included in earnings at any time, other than if you sell the subsidiary, of course. The second most important item is cash flow hedges relating to currencies, which I find extremely helpful, because the separation in a value change and the recycling all of a sudden gives me information about the effect in the P&L that I had not come across for all the companies previously. Some of them have given me that information separately in the text in the quarter reports, for instance. Now I can see it, oh, unfortunately not in all companies in the quarter report, but in the annual report I can find the effect on the P&L by looking in the OCI on the recycled amount. And the third most important has been pensions. And roughly 15 companies or so in Sweden has voluntarily introduced that now IAS 19 already a couple of years ago. And just to give you an example how useful that is from a user perspective, if you take a well-known pharmaceutical company called AstraZeneca, and if you look in the OCI or in the change in equity from 2005 and until today, each year they recognize a negative revaluation on the pension, net pension liability. Now that kind of information is of course useful, because the immediate idea is probably the pension cost over time is too low calculated. So whether I adjust for that or just take that into my risk assumption, that's up to me, but it's definitely useful information. What do I not find in the OCI? Well, of course, as you mentioned, the revaluations of investment property according to IAS 40, and also from a Swedish perspective, extremely important in the forest companies, revaluation of biological assets. Three of the companies have massive forest holdings, and the revaluations they do on forest is just ridiculous. Sometimes it shows up, sometimes they don't do anything, and all of a sudden they match it to restructuring costs. So it's just a ridiculous mess of accounting that shows up in those big companies. And it's the same for all three. So they obviously talk to each other. And they can include the revaluation a certain quarter, and also find a lot of restructuring that quarter. Okay? And also I don't find, which I can see in the financial net normally, you can have, it's rare, but it happens that you have revaluations of equity holdings included. And currency effects, that it shows up for receivables or liabilities in the financial net. So my view, since I think this is a very useful concept, is the broadest possible. Because I cannot really see the distinction between these three groups. And if I add to GEL the revaluation of the environmental liability, I definitely, if it relates to an interest rate, I definitely would think it fits better in the OCI than in the P&L. So my view is the broadest possible. All revaluations should be included in OCI. Okay, then we can talk about the short-term assets and liabilities. The receivables, customer receivables, liabilities to suppliers, currency changes on those. For practical purposes, I can have short-term assets and short-term liabilities if they are monetary left out, meaning the revaluation goes into P&L, partly because a short-term asset and a short-term liability creates fairly small numbers. It's the long-term ones that actually creates the substantial revaluations. And I think it's also very important to have the OCI clearly separated from the P&L. I don't want a total profit report, and I'm definitely agree with Peter Elwin that when the report arrives, there are a timeline. Within a couple of minutes, you need to just take a number and try to evaluate whether this is good or not. And then as time goes by, we dig in further into the report, and a year later maybe also into the footnotes, but that is more rare. That happens, but it's more rare. So my view is definitely, I think this is a valuable concept, and I think if we broaden it it would be even more useful. But the recycling is very important. And it is, to me, quite easy to do recyclings if we connect it to a realization of the gain or the loss included in the OCI. One item, and also maybe these environmental liabilities, is in the same group. When you have pension, it's costly at least to find the actual transaction being done in the future, to take that caution of the liability into the income statement. And for that purpose, I think, and also when I look at AstraZeneca, I think that some kind of amortization of the item in the OCI is necessary for pension.
It may be worth consolidating before we leave the topic, but we've heard from
just a quick one. Just some of the earlier comments we had when we were talking about sophisticated users and those who were less sophisticated. Peter's talked about his analysis and how he analysed the OCI and concluded there was an understatement of the pension expense. And I'm just wondering whether there's an inconsistency there, that the sophisticated user can go through the OCI and draw a conclusion on the pension expense that's gone through the income statement versus what they believe should have gone through the income statement. Perhaps other people wouldn't do that analysis and would miss that. And so I'm just trying to balance the users and who the users might be.
The OCI is definitely not an item that is reported in the newspapers. That's for sure. So from that perspective, it's a special item.
I think Peter's actually, what he's just described is actually, you could use, transitory remeasurements could be the definition for OCI. Once you start saying that, and I'm really glad that we're now confronting the issue, what you're saying is that fair value or market values for certain assets or liabilities aren't relevant enough to put through the P&L. So it's actually getting them to the nub of when fair value or market value measurement should be in the primary statement or not. But it is potentially opening a can of worms, but it is a very fundamental philosophical issue. So I think it's great that you've introduced this idea of transitory remeasurement. I think I find it attractive. I mean, personally, I wouldn't go for bridging of the three. The first one I would leave out would be bridging, and just so you have to decide on that on the accounting treatment. And so they're having this funny, P&L form. But I think what Peter described is basically transitory remeasurement. OCI is transitory remeasurement, and then let's think about quite a long list of things you could do that for, or a short list, depending on where you're coming from.
I disagree with that. I think bridging and mismatch, those sort of conceptual frameworks tend to be very, very clear. I sort of agree with the idea that we're looking at assets and liabilities through one lens in the P&L and another lens on the balance sheet, and we need therefore sort of sort that out, particularly if those assets or liabilities are sold off or closed out in some way. So bridging, looks good to me from that perspective. I think it's quite a tight definition. Mismatching cash flow hedge, I think, is a great example. And again, in both of those categories, I think sort of compulsory recycling, that sort of solves the recycling debate. Do we do it, don't we do it? Yes, we always do it. And again, you've got a nice, clear rationale behind why. But the transitory is the one that worries me. I'm not convinced by the pensions example. I think there are ways of identifying the things in pension sort of structures that should be going through OCI, but using bridging or mismatching as the justification. I don't think we need a third category for that, necessarily. I'm very interested to understand what would the consequence be of setting a narrow definition of OCI. What are the things that are sort of lying around out there that would suddenly sort of crunch up against the framework and we'd be going, oh right, well that doesn't fit. You made the point that we wouldn't necessarily have to immediately do something, we could take 30 or 30 years, but it would be interesting to note what are the things that would sort of be sitting outside the pale with that narrow framework. But I absolutely wouldn't start with a very broad definition of OCI, because I think, again, I'm persuaded by your suggestion that the P&L is the sort of the default, and we identify things that would be unhelpful to have in the P&L. I think that seems to me to be the right starting point. So it would be strange then to have a very, very broad definition of OCI, because I think we'd end up in an unhelpful place.
So if I can, I think actually I'm actually a little sympathetic to OCI, or at least what you're trying to do, because I acknowledge we're starting from here. So from here, what do you do? And trying to sort of put some sort of logic and we don't have the top level, but at least we can sort of try to build the middle level for the moment. I think we need more work on the transition type ones. I actually looked at some of the categories and some of the words and say, you know, I'm not fussed with it, but I think you need to tighten that one up. If the P&L is the primary statement, if we can, for the moment, put that as a place marker in the conceptual framework, that means you've got to be consistent. That means everything's got to be recycled. It's flowing. It's the logical flow from that, and then you have to deal with what happens about pension. Is pension not recycled because there's no event, or do we force some sort of arbitrary recycling? When you recycle, you're going to have an opportunity to crystallize an event. So you've got this mismatch, amortized costs, and it could be your own debt, it could be something else, and you say, love to improve my P&L today. JP Morgan call, I sell it, I crystallize it. So that's going to be, and we're going to have to live with that. The biggest problem with OCI is it's not, frankly, I don't think it's consistently applied. And so if you make some rules, apply them consistently, over time go back and say, well, you know, there are a few things that aren't in OCI that now maybe we should rewrite the standards, and I think it's over a 30-year timeline. I think we might be able to salvage something out of something that currently is a little messy.
Yeah,
I guess the problem with the broad definition, the example around pension expenses and the revaluation of pension expenses is that, you know, why, if a company miscalculates, you know, bad debts, or past, you know, next year they'll calculate it again to impact the P&L, why the pension fund should be different? The idea of transitory is, you know, I always like the idea that if you're in a pension fund, you have a huge portfolio of equities obviously they go up and down, and then as moving earnings to OCI, that's fine. But if it's something permanent, so why should you hide that number in, so if you're not hiding others?
Comment on Jane's comment. I don't think the purpose of the OCI should be that all fair value is being brought down to OCI. I think there are many fair value things that still should remain P&L.
I wasn't suggesting. I was just saying that we're getting to the nub of the issue.
Here. No, I think that would I don't think that would enhance the start point. And on Peter's comment, as broad as possible, I think you mentioned so many good examples of where OCI is useful, and that I wouldn't go as far as saying as broad as possible, because then we run into the risk that abuse and earnings management takes over from enhancing insight. I mean, but I think we're very much on the same page. It's maybe just semantics.
Thank you. I come to with the three distinction of the OCI, but I think that everything should be recycled. And in order to explain my position, let me briefly look back the history. Taking example of the available for sale securities. In the past, good old days, it was kept in, you know, cost. As market value of these securities changes, people thought that it would be better to reflect the changes into the equity section of the balance sheet. so that the security, financial security of the companies can be better recognized. This is the step two. The step three is that because of these items, so-called the accumulated OCI today, fluctuate every year. People thought it might be better to put a little one line at the bottom of the profit and loss statement and call it the other comprehensive income and show the differences of these accumulated OCI. So to me and to many investors, accumulated OCI is only a note or piece of information so that you got to pay some attention to the balance sheet, because without you are knowing it, there are certain changes in the equity or the balance sheet. So nobody thinks OCI is income, except some people who believe in a cult called asset and liability views. But we investors are no cult people, we are ordinary common sense oriented people. And therefore, I think when something is recognized in OCI, that is necessary because we want to know the financial stability. But the income statement, we see the very different purposes because we want to see the financial result of the company, performance, continuing performance. In doing so, I made a research a couple of years ago sending a survey for our members. And then one line item they put most emphasis on the income statement is operating income. Then some use the EBITDA from that, because that is a very low number which shows the cash generating, profit generating ability of the company. A second important number is net income. This is the bottom line. After paying everything, that is left for the shareholders to be paid out in dividends someday. So these two numbers, they see, and nobody see the, basically the comprehensive income at all. There are many reasons why everything should be recycled, but let me mention only one. Anyway, people will continue to see the earnings, because people cannot see so many numbers at the same time, and media also always want one number. If we exclude some items, not recycle them, then accumulated net income will not be the same with the changes of the equity over the time. So this is the one reason why we need everything to be recycled. And then recycled, why do we recycle? Because of the realization that Peter just mentioned. Realization here means that whenever asset or liability goes out of the company, then resulting loss or profit will be recorded in net income. And this will be useful for the stewardship of the company, because the management performance, everything will be reported in net income over the time. Thank you.
Mary, you can make a very long
slide. I think it's more important to hear from the FIMAC members, so happy to wait. I wanted to reassure members about one thing, which is, we did not, in developing the discussion paper, constrain what we put forward by having to rationalize existing practice. We certainly went back and looked at decisions that we made at a standards level to see if, when you step back and say, what was the driver, why did we do this, is there a useful hook, is there something we can look at, but we did not say, we've got to find some way to rationalize all the decisions we made in the past, so that we don't have to change any of them. So there is interplay with the past, but it's not a constraint that we placed on ourselves. So I wanted to say that, and I wanted to say that very, very directly, because I think it's important to how you look at the weighing of different alternatives. Certainly one of the messages I think we keep starting to dip into and then step back from is financial statement presentation. There's an obvious linkage between some of the things we're discussing here and FSP, but I think FSP and the question of what should the board do for a standards level project about presentation of primary financial statements are two related but separate things. And we want to get the conceptual framework right so it provides the right starting point for what we do at a standards level. But this is not the FFP project. We certainly are drawing learning points that we have from the work that we're done already, but we're not going to do this instead of FFP. And I think one of the messages I'm taking away, this is the first stage of conceptual framework. What we're hearing as feedback already is certainly from users the importance of going back to financial statement presentation project. And I think that's something I would expect to come through loud and clear in the next agenda consultation. But that's kind of the follow on, and it makes it more important that we get this done and get the groundwork cleared away. And the third thing is just what I've heard today. I'll tell you, and maybe I'm hearing it through the lens of the discussions we've had, is many people who have spoken have talked about what do we want to filter out of what we put in P&L so that we still have the information about these events or transactions that have occurred, changes in discount rates perhaps, and what they would mean to the measurement of a recognized liability or asset. And I think it's coming back to this notion of OCI is potentially, not universally for everybody here, potentially useful to keep information presented, but not making noise in a P&L measure, which is not the only measure of performance, but is an important performance indicator. Let me characterize it as that. And going all the way back to Peter's slide 7, I think all we were trying to say here is there's no single one magic silver bullet. And I think the board, and we would say the board and not individual preparers, might, these are the factors that we might consider more than one, not always a single one. Maybe two or three of them might be things we consider as we work through a standard in terms of saying, do we say it's this attribute, maybe it's measurement uncertainty, maybe it's long-term versus short-term, that causes us to say at a standards level, this is the reason why X aspect might be put into OCI. But fundamentally, we couldn't say it's all about recurring or non-recurring, because we just couldn't define what is recurring or non-recurring. So I think it's that filter notion. So those are three things that it's related to FSP, it's drawing on FSP, but this is not the FSP project. It's providing a platform for that. And certainly I'm hearing a lot of views about the importance of restarting FSP. We weren't constrained, and I think I hear a lot that reinforces the notion of some kind of filter as the role of OCI.
Final word.
It's actually probably similar to what Mary was saying, but in general, because I just wanted to have a lot of thoughts in my head about OCI and P&L and discussions with users. And I just wanted to, I think some people have already done this, but encourage you when we talk to you about what you're looking for to give us feedback on why you want what you want where. I understand there are different reasons for different people, but I think it's important for us and for the staff to understand. So when you're saying, I like this remeasurement here and this one here, continue to tell us why. Because even though we're not defining performance, we have to still think about why are we putting this in P&L. I think you were touching on some of it. Why is it going in OCI? Why is it important for you to still see it? Why does the company want to see it recycled? Why do others like it broad? Why do others like it more narrow? And I think there's got to be some coherent or cohesive, I hope there are some, consistent reasons throughout that we can pull on those and use those when we're making our decisions.
I think we probably need to call this one and shorten the break. We'll have a 10-minute break and everything for the next topic.
10 minutes.
No, I have my electricity.
I'm actually using your power, not your
Can we just look at this one?